Welcome to the Collection on Audio Boom. On this week's show, Simon French, Chief Economist at Panmure Gordon.
The most dangerous time in financial markets is when everyone is consensual. Invariably, when everyone running for the door, it is the time to go long.
Rory Broomfield from campaign group The Freedom Association.
The European Union has morphed into this beast that doesn't represent UK values, doesn't represent UK interests, and doesn't represent the British people who cannot throw the buggers out.
And Francis Hunt, better known as the market sniper.
The analysts weren't going into Las Vegas strip joints and running into strippers who had portfolios of 20 properties on a cash basis income.
I never thought we'd be talking about strippers on the show.
Exactly. I'm trying to spice the show up there. give us some latitude, Joe. You've got to bring sex in there.
The Brexit campaign was given an unusual boost by Annunciata Rees-Mogg, who reminded us that Hitler would have most likely backed the Stay campaign, given his attempts in the 1940s to create a united Europe. In contrast, a slightly less right-wing leader, Margaret Thatcher, was described as most likely being anti-Brexit by her former private secretary, Lord Pole. There was subsequent criticism of invoking the dead to score political points. That said, it might be imagined by some that the late British Prime Minister would rise from the grave with a no, no, no to handbag anyone accusing her of being pro-EU. Elsewhere in the Eurozone, banking stocks tumbled, with Deutsche Bank's shares hitting a 30-year low. CEO John Cryan described his bank's balance sheet as being rock solid, or in common parlance, we are likely to be declared insolvent within a week. Similar assurances were delivered just days before the Swiss National Bank abandoned the euro peg last year. Meanwhile, Fed Chair Janet Yellen caused the FTSE 100 to fall to four-year lows as further interest rate cuts were not ruled out later this year in the US. The gold price soared while the UK's Randgold Resources became the best performer of 2016 by quite a wide margin. Finally, we had some insight into the recent Google tax controversy as Matt Britton, president of Google Europe, responded to questions about his salary by saying, "I don't have the figure." Presumably, it is quite difficult to pay tax if you don't know how much you earn. Okay, welcome to the Collection from Audio Boom. With me in the studio, Simon French, Chief Economist at Panmure Gordon, Francis Hunt, otherwise known as the Market Sniper, and Rory Broomfield, who is Director of the Freedom Association. Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Good afternoon.
Right, it's time for the hard hats. If you're looking at the stock market at the moment, I think around 5,500 on the FTSE 100. So we're well below what was the sort of the normal floor for the UK market. Blue chip stocks around 6,000. That was in place for what, sort of 15 years, which is not great in the sense that the market didn't actually go anywhere for 15 years. But now we can't even cope with that. Simon French, have you got any explanation as to what is going on, which will stop us jumping out the window?
Look, we can stem this back to the fall in the global commodity market, accentuated by the recent decline in oil, which is now only behind the great financial crisis in terms of bubbles having burst. It's overtaken previous crises, valuation crises. And there are second order effects. Look, the first order effects were clearly those direct commodity companies, but actually there's a series of finance houses that sit behind a lot of that lending who are now feeling the pain in terms of their equity valuations. Well, the question for most listeners is, you know, is this a time to panic? Is this a time to expect the kind of conditions in the real economy that we got in 2008-09? Or, as what a lot of the charts suggest, we're more in that kind of 2011-2012 euro crisis, where it's a little bit more contained within a certain part of the economy and hasn't yet spread into what I describe as the real economy. You know, on the high street, the things that matter, you know, credit lending, it matters about employment and wage growth. Thus far, in most of the developed world, those indicators aren't flashing amber. They certainly aren't flashing red. So I remain, you know, relaxed on the basis of the real economy. But you are really quite concerned that the financial conditions may curb lending, and that's, for me, the key indicator to look for in the coming months.
Well, I obviously know much more about economics than most because I've been a stock market commentator for many years. I went to the LSE for as long as 6 weeks studying economics, and that's all you need, really, isn't it? As you should know as well. But my theory is that we've had deflation for the last, say, 2, 3, 4, 5 years, something like that. Deflation means smaller profits for companies, lower dividends, and hence stocks are less attractive. So the happy scenario here is that what we're seeing is just a stock market phenomenon caused by deflation and nothing else.
Yeah, and I'd add to that the fact there's an awful lot of adjustment still to go on post the financial crisis. You know, and that may sound like a strange thing to say 6 years, 7 years on, but a lot of the infrastructure surrounding financial services is still not fit for purpose. It's still too big to fail. There is still the cost base of a lot of the financial services that is not yet adjusted to the reality both of deflation, which is an important one, but also the tanks that have been firmly planted on their lawn by fintech and the challenges of new business models that don't have those overheads. So, look, you know, if you're in financial services right now, as quite a few of us are, you are concerned about the impact that the current market turbulence will have on the future business model.
So we're in the age of disruption. I mean, the financial markets are suffering from the online competitors, the new mammals are sort of hitting the big dinosaurs out there, little rats are scurrying around.
Yeah, well, financial services are looked on as the disruption has gone through the music industry, through the publishing industry. It has gone into all other parts of the real economy, you know, in terms of automation of services. And a lot of the white-collar and blue-collar jobs that we were used to in previous cycles have disappeared and been replaced, or at least have morphed into something that is very unfamiliar for a lot of people. It's coming to financial services, and those that will survive out the back end are those who can adapt, who can adjust their business model. Those who think that, you know, actually the return to 4.5%, 5%, you know, interest rates globally, 2% inflation that you can hang your hat on, those kind of economic conditions where a business model was sustainable in that environment, I'm sorry, they're not returning.
All right, but just to finish on this particular area of discussion, isn't it also the case that 2007, 2008, the central banks, governments intervened, lowered interest rates to zero, bailed out failed entities, and now we've got our the comeuppance of zero rates creating zero inflation and all these dinosaurs which should have been allowed to die, like RBS, Lloyd's Bank, etc., or HBOS at least, they're going to break down.
See, I don't agree. Look, the policy prescription at the time of zero interest rates, a big coordinated fiscal stimulus globally, was exactly the right thing to happen. It diverted actually a depression. We had a great recession. We didn't have a depression. You know, the reality was the sustainability of that recovery job was always going to be how subsequently businesses, governments reacted to the period post the crisis, the regulatory structure, the kind of environment they had to operate in. And I'm afraid a lot of them have failed the test. And what was staggering from markets yesterday was that a lot of the financial sector was egging Janet Yellen on to talk about negative interest rates, QE4. I mean, if they think that that is going to materially impact, all it does is it buys a little bit more time. But effectively, it's pushing on a string. If you loosen your monetary policy, you have three impacts. You loosen your currency, you make credit lending somewhat cheaper, and you have a wealth effect through asset price appreciation. It's unclear to me that any of those are possible in the current environment, not least because everybody's trying currency devaluation. The wealth effect we know is fairly unequally distributed around the real economy. And credit actually is, there's no signs actually that the constraint on growth is coming from credit markets. So actually, as we've seen in the Eurozone, lowering rates into negative territory doesn't actually see a big pickup in lending to households and to businesses.
Well, thank you, Simon. You've agreed with me on two points. The first is that the 2007-2008 intervention was a can-kicking process. We've run out of time on the can-kick, and also it hasn't addressed any of the structural problems that we had, so it was the wrong cure for the disease. So a double agreement in a strange way, let's say. Moving on to Rory Broomfield, we've got disruption in the financial area. We've also got political disruption. We're in a very revolutionary time, maybe the most revolutionary time since the 1960s, I would say, in some ways. Probably quite, I mean, actually, well, pick up on the 1960s, the state of the US, the sort of the relationship between the police and the black minority in the South is just the same. It's just exactly the same situation there as we had then, even though we have a black president, or maybe because we have a black president. But in Europe, the whole system then, whole system there of nations and economies and everything else is also breaking down, isn't it?
It is, absolutely. And it's got to the state where certain member states are very different in their policy outlooks to others. And in previous years, especially with the European Union, they've muddled along with certain policy objectives of the Eurozone and deeper integration and all that. But now with other problems raising the temperature, shall we say, in Europe, the governments across the European Union are seeing, well, we're seeing quite a difference of opinion emerging by how to deal with problems, whether they be Greece or whether they be, of course, quite recently with refugees coming and migrants coming into the European Union.
But do you think that the EU was a fatally flawed idea from day one, or do you think that it had a purpose in the 50s and 60s after the Second World War to prevent Germany giving us another World War, but it's run its course on in terms of that idea, which is a charitable way of looking at it. But now in the age of the internet and the age of sort of a global economy, it doesn't work.
Well, certainly for some nations within the European Union in the 1950s, etc., it was the right thing to do. And in those terms and the treaties that were signed at that time, the EU, as we now know it, is a very different beast to that that was in the 1950s, etc., and indeed includes many more countries, including the United Kingdom. And it's not the right model for the UK. Indeed, as you rightly say, the global financial and technological environment has changed significantly.
Well, yeah, let me pick you up on the UK issue, because the UK in 1974 or 75 was like Greece, and a country like that, which is a second or third rate economy, which UK, well, the UK nearly it had a bailout from the IMF, so it's the same. It's almost the same. I mean, obviously we have other institutions here, maybe stronger, but the UK at that time did. It was quite compelling to be raised up to the level of the other EU nations. And the situation now is that we're so much stronger. We've actually benefited from the failure of the EU. All the money, we have a capital flight from the Eurozone into London, into the city of London, which has really helped out. But the situation now. There's no way that the UK should be in the EU in any form. It's just a total disaster. Is that the way you look at it?
Well, yes. And indeed, from the 70s until now, you didn't have the treaties such as Maastricht and Nice and Amsterdam, and indeed the recent one over Lisbon. And you didn't have the European External Action Service. You didn't have issues to do with the justice and home affairs provisions that the EU now has. And indeed, in the financial markets, you didn't have the type of rhetoric that we're now talking about. And indeed, there wasn't even the single currency. The UK did and has benefited from the catastrophic decisions made by other EU member states with the Eurozone. But the UK needs to look at the wider picture, and the wider picture is the global economy and being able to take our own decisions to formulate trade deals and make the benefits of the opportunities that lie outside the European Union and take a hold of that opportunity going forward.
But I mean, what's the benefit of the? I mean, let's say we leave in June, or it's a gradual phase out then, but. Is it really anything? Is the UK any better than just being a country which has a booming housing market, which has basically saved the day for most people? But there wasn't that. If house prices were flat, we'd be just like any other EU country. And also the issue of having our own currency. Those are the only two differences. But apart from that, it's there's not really much in it.
Well, there are significant differences beyond that, such as, soft power in terms of the English language, and there's also the legal system, which is very different to the legal system of Greece and other EU member states, which allows, indeed, for business terms and corporate terms, M&A and what have you, a very different environment to do business in. And in the UK, we also have global industries that have never even come to Greece, whether it be financial services or others, such as manufacturing. So there is a very different economy for the United Kingdom. There is a different outlook and indeed many other different opportunities that the UK could grasp hold of if we left.
So we're much more entrepreneurial, much more innovative than many other countries, apart from perhaps Germany.
Maybe in some areas. Certainly Germany has its own strengths. It has a different sort of economy, a mercantile economy, which the UK now no longer has to that extent. And the UK does have the benefits, as I just outlined, as well as global connections with the Anglosphere and elsewhere that are growing and want to do business.
Well, it's quite weird that actually asking you that question, it sounds less compelling. I'm not quite sure why, but anyway, we'll go on to Francis Hunt, the market sniper. The $64,000 question from this point is, we've got the dip in the market. You are the sort of the guru in terms of predicting or spotting setups in stocks and markets and commodities. Can you get out your crystal ball and tell us what you think is going to happen, your best call over the next, let's say, the next year?
Yes, thanks, Zach. Well, coming in on how Simon had to field a question, also he works for a bank, so he's in a bit of a compromised position. I'm lucky to be able to say I work for myself, so I can dig my own holes and fall into them and only be accountable to myself. But in terms of the big question, there should really only be one huge discussion at the moment, and I feel like a little bit like the Cassandra, because all the dominoes are dropping around us right now as we speak. So in terms of how I might have answered your very opening question, I certainly do think, while I wouldn't use the phrase panic, I certainly do think positive defensive action should be taken by all people right now on an extreme level. And I'll tell you why maybe people should consider my opinion worthwhile. We were one of the first forecasting the turn in oil at $103, and we said it's going to be a chronic downswing and it's going to overperform substantially to the downside. So we were short in there. On the Euro-Swiss franc, not once but twice in 2009, before we even knew about the euro crisis, we were getting a substantial 30% move on the Euro-Swiss franc. And then when the peg was in place, we called for the peg to fail in October. And after the SNB came out in December and said it was central to their policy, we said, forget Q1, it's going to happen in January, on the basis that central bankers don't tell you the truth. They tell you what they need you to hear for you to keep on carrying on and staying calm. And I'm more interested in actually the real truth, and the charts are where I find it. The interesting thing about charting, though, is you can come up with a technical opinion and you don't know the headline until later. So last year, September, I did the YouTube clip, Deutsche Bank to go bust, stroke, bail in. I don't believe it'll ever be actually allowed to go bust, because a key technical level in a known continuation pattern triggered. And the problem is, people might say, really? And you're making fundamental calls on the basis of that? I'm afraid that they tend to come true often.
How did you pick out Deutsche Bank? Because it's just like, even now, it's the CEO has said that the bank's rock solid. I mean, there's nothing wrong with it.
Well, the interesting thing is, if you look at a relative strength chart for all the banks post the subprime boom, someone like Wells Fargo and a few others have actually, rallied quite strongly in the US post that. Even the mid-range and the investment banks had. But in terms of the response, we got what was very much a dead cat bounce out of Deutsche. And I must go further and to forewarn, to maybe bring the panic a little bit onshore, because there's been a little bit of UK smugness towards, maybe one of the biggest banks in Germany being in a situation. Barclays is no better and is in a classic downside position. I just haven't had the time to YouTube it, but it cracked at £2, and we said that's a key move, and this is rolling over. So to me, behind the scenes, unbeknownst to you and I, there's stuff going down.
Yeah, but why don't we? This is one of the things I wanted to talk to Rory about. It seems to be in an age of information overload, on any big issue, We don't know anything. It's a blackout.
Absolutely.
And you hear every opinion apart from the one that says, you know, like the rock solid comment from the CEO of Deutsche Bank,
which is
like, you know, that means, oh, right, for me that means, okay, that means they're going to be bust within a week.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, this is the
we have a sort of delayed we either have the blind spots or we have a delayed democratic process where, you know, they say, oh, actually afterwards they say, oh, well, you know, it was like this, but, you know, it was better that, you know, people didn't know about it, would have created panic. So there's no point having a transparent society.
It reminds me of the Jack Nicklaus
scene. Or allegedly transparent society.
Do you remember the film A Few Good Men? The truth, you can't handle the truth. That was in Jack Nicklaus's great big rant to Tom Cruise about being on a military base on a key border. And I think there's a large amount of this mentality in the central banking axis, if you want to call them that. And I think having all of us now drawing out cash and loading up our mattress accounts right now does not serve the benefit of the system. I think people pulling in their horns and stopping all consumption and doing all smart defensive related aspects in an environment where we have so many unstable banks around us, and they are all so interconnected in the basis that if, you know, prominent bank, I mean, Deutsche on its own is, I don't need to describe how massive an institution that is and how many cross holdings it'll be. It is enough on its own to pull a whole tent down.
That's bad lending. I mean, they've engaged in bad lending, or they've been disrupted by smaller players, or is it both? Or is it just a perfect storm?
Technically, I'm brought to believe that they never fully recovered from the subprime. And when you read the books and the narratives that follow, because I always love the fundamental and the news. You know, I studied fundamental. I value my economic understanding fairly highly. But we found that they apart from AIG, seemed to be the dumbest money in the room. In other words, in the US, as it was starting to leak, that subprime was leaking, they were dislocated from, you know, Detroit and the slums. The analysts weren't going into Las Vegas strip joints and running into strippers who had portfolios of 20 properties on a cash basis income. They weren't getting these on-the-ground signals that were pointing that there was, serious...
I never thought we were talking about strippers on the show.
Exactly. I'm trying to spice the show up. give us some latitude, Jay. You've got
to
bring sex in.
Right. Simon French, I just wanted to get your opinion on this, because you used to work for the government, the UK government, and you know, part of this sort of discussion about freedom of information and the governments, you know, and sort of, you know, the banks saying one thing and the reality being something else, you get into that sort of paranoia of, you know, this—it's almost like the sort of the X-Files—a paranoia about there's an agenda. We're not being told; we've been treated like children. Is it actually like that, or is it? There's just, you know, I mean, you see what I mean?
Well, the answer is always more more subtle than extreme positions. So there are occasions where you get self-fulfilling valuation crises based on, on information that actually isn't fundamental to the financial outlook of a particular company. So I can understand why there are, any CEO worth their salt in this environment is going to take the stance that John Cryan has at Deutsche. How can we change the infrastructure? Because you mentioned government. Do we apply freedom of information across? I mean, there's already talk of applying it to government companies that contract with government. Do you extend that to private institutions? That runs into commercial confidentiality. There's a chilling effect in terms of what is published. The problem is, it is a little bit more nuanced than taking an extreme position of transparency to allow market participants to have full information. I mean, in many cases, the reality is there is not a single entity within any organisation of the size of Deutsche that really knows the full story. And that was one of the findings that we found after the subprime crisis, is that these organisations are too big to manage. If I get too big to fail, they were too big to manage. So the idea that a CEO of an entity the size of Deutsche can know what sits within each part of its portfolio is inconceivable. The point I didn't make in my opening statement around the necessary policy intervention in 2008, the necessary monetary policy of, you know, near zero interest rates, bought us time. It bought us nothing more. It's bought us 7 years. That's fortunate. But the completion of the project to end too big to fail, the end of the project to regulate lending appropriately, the firewall between the investment bank and the retail deposit. This all needs to be completed. And it's very, very easy in recent years where growth has been back to near trend to try and forget about that and move it to the right. But I think what will come out of this is a renewed emphasis to try and complete the project that was started.
But it sort of also goes back to my sort of feeling that governments and regulators are the wrong people to be trying to change or evolve business or business practices.
So, Zach, who should be?
It's down to profits and losses. The companies that go bust have got the wrong ways of working. RBS should have gone bust. Let's say Barclays doesn't. RBS had bad practices. It made bad choices. It bought ABN AMRO, did the wrong thing.
Yeah.
It shouldn't have been saved.
So I agree with you on the point of moral hazard. It's gone. It's left. But the problem is that removing moral hazard from the scene in the state of a crisis in 2008-09 was the correct policy response. I'll stick to that position. But at some point, you have to take the uncomfortable decision of bringing risk back onto the table to allow entities to fail. And if that means winding in forbearance, winding in the kind of levels of state support that were necessary, they should have been done and in the main haven't been done. And that's the bit that when I say that the project needs to be completed, that is the element that will come out of if we get a sustained valuation crisis now. That's what will be required, because the taxpayer won't be on the hook, or should not be on the hook, a second time round.
The only problem with we can say that it was better to save the day in 2008, but if the crash in 2016 is four times worse than that, or there's civil unrest, or there's conflict or whatever, we turn into World War III, then that delay might have made the crash that we're going to have much worse than it would have been. So that's the problem, that you delay something and you make the reaction much, much worse. So that intervention there, which I disagree with anyway, because it's like the People's Bank of China bailing out. The People's Bank of China are doing what the Western governments did with their banks 7 or 8 years ago. They're copying the failed model of that, and they're putting in $100 billion a month in order to save their stock market and save their pride as well. And it's just going to be a disaster. You have a harder landing. When you intervene, you create a harder landing than when you don't.
No, Zach, I fundamentally don't agree with you. You buy yourself time.
That was the 1930s. Yeah, the 1930s, that's what happened in the 1930s.
Yeah, but you buy yourself time. If you then fail at the second stage and the necessary corrective stage, that doesn't mean the initial intervention was incorrect. It means you failed in the follow-up.
Yeah.
You know, there was a saying, don't waste a crisis. The crisis was the opportunity to do a lot of corrective surgery to the financial system, which wasn't fit for purpose. It hasn't been completed. Now, I'm not suggesting that more regulation needs to be brought in place. What I'm saying is that the regulation that has been put in place is not fit for purpose as we stand here today to enable the financial sector to be resilient to wild swings in commodity prices, the kind of spikes in non-performing loans that we're starting to see in emerging markets. If it's not resilient enough, then the resilience work that has been done thus far by regulators hasn't done the job.
How does a bank with 54 trillion in derivative exposure ever be immune from wild swings in anything? I just don't think. Not that it was even started properly with the original causes. These things needed taking down entirely, and the surgery was never, in terms of what was totally required, to use Simon's analogy. I don't think we really got started at all. I think all we did, because we have a political system where it's based on tenor, everybody just hopes Louis the 15th after me the storm, and they get out of their little political thing and say the bomb never blew up on mine. We've pulled the pin, the hand grenade's being passed down the line, and better hope it's more than 10 seconds left. And that's my take. And the problem is, eventually it's like getting squeezed into a corner of a wedge. Eventually there is so little room to move, and you've kept adding to it in a compounding basis, because the patch over fixes actually make the system worse and more vulnerable, that you almost guarantee
the eventuality, and you guarantee that it would be far bigger than if you'd ever done it correctly the first time. And I actually believe we're in the process of the beginning of that unraveling, and you should expect it to be even bigger than 2008. And I'm sorry to be the bearer of bad news.
Is there any time that we can compare that which would be analogous to now?
I don't think in modern history we've ever had something like this. People will go, oh, what about the Great Depression in America? Largely, that was, America had the heat, was at the heat of that. It wasn't that it was great elsewhere in the globe. We have never had such an interconnected economic system whereby an event like this would be so far-reaching and so global. And again, it sounds like I'm being dramatic for the sake of drama, and I don't intend to come across like that. Mm. But this is far, far reaching because everything is now connected together. You know, I mean, the Chinese are buying, you know, have a direct line for buying treasuries. They start doing something on their side. You can't. Mm. Everybody is involved in the game.
Simon, have you got any boring end game on this one? Something which is like we'd look back and laugh at this?
Well, you know, the only point I would make is that the most dangerous time in financial markets is when everyone is consensual. If everyone is consensual bear right now, it is you look go through the history of market economies, and invariably the crowd is wrong. Invariably, when everyone running for the door, it is the time to go long. Now that is not suggesting that this time will follow the pattern, but it hasn't broken down thus far. Pretty much every occasion the retail investor goes, it's too risky, I want to get out, it's the perfect time to enter into
it. But I don't believe that correctly summarizes how people are. I think in terms of watching the mainstream media, it is. In fact, everything is fine. There's a couple of little readjustments going on, but carry on. There's a small, I would say the 9% of independent market media commentators, I'd probably like to put myself in that bracket, that are actually saying it's serious, serious trouble. I believe the man in the street actually has no idea. He just thinks there's a bit of a sell-off in the stock market right now.
Okay, I'm speaking with Rory Broomfield, director of the Freedom Association. Rory, what is the Freedom Association all about? It sounds like a sort of hippie collective.
Far from it, I would say, but we believe in the individual and we believe in promoting the individual in any way, shape or form we can. And we are a group that instill those principles into campaigns of the day. Campaigns have previously been successful against the closed shop, opening up the labour market in the United Kingdom, and we currently are into the campaign on the EU, where we run the Better Off Out campaign, putting the positive case for an independent UK outside of the EU.
Well, the problem is, I mean, even if you're a fan of the idea of the Freedom Association, which I think that it, you know, it does obviously sound like a good thing, it would appear that the whole momentum of events and of life in general over the last 40 years seems to be going the other way. I mean, 1984 was the big sort of example of the nanny state and Big Brother is watching you and all the other nightmares. And, you know, basically you can't even sneeze, let's say, without it being recorded, tracked down and just generally analysed, et cetera, et cetera.
Yes, I completely agree. But it also means that organisations like the Freedom Association are incredibly important to try to turn the tide.
That makes you sound like the King Canute Association. I mean, as I said, the momentum is so bad. I mean, in the financial markets, we had the ultimate nanny state action in 2007, 2008, bailing out failed banks. Since then, we've got the EU desperate in a draconian way to keep Greece in within the fold, and you know, all sorts of can-kicking incentives, and well, I suppose also behaving a bit like a sort of like a gangster. It's like they're like gangsters, really. You can't leave, or you can vote anything, which is we've had that with the EU. You can vote anything as long as it's stay with us.
Absolutely,
and you can keep voting again and again until you come up with the right answer.
Yeah, they have said EU officials have said that in the past, and actually with reference to that, the EU referendum that we'll be having in the UK over the next few months, maybe even as soon as June, will be an opportunity for individuals around the United Kingdom who are dissatisfied with that state of affairs, dissatisfied with the whole swathes of power and money and increase in, in surveillance in a whole range of different ways to mark their cross, etc., next to the leave and make a stand against what we are saying today and in the past few years, which has been increasing governmental power.
Yeah, but the unfortunate thing is the government is so strong now, they can basically, the campaign is going to be bent. It is obviously, you know, through polling, through social media, through the BBC, through whatever, it's just totally skewed. I mean, the Scottish referendum, I think, was a dry run. You could see just, all parties united to keep Scotland. Mm. And they, you know, the Liberals and the Labour, Miliband and Clegg, both sacrificed their careers in order to, which is a good thing, really, I suppose, but they sacrificed their careers in order to keep Scotland in.
It really, you're absolutely spot on. It's the establishment versus the people. And the establishment doesn't just come with governmental strings and the taxpayer-funded. It comes with a whole range of other groups and organisations. And you see
fear tactics. I mean, the fear tactics have already come through.
Oh, yeah.
Putin would like it if there was Brexit. Mm. Thatcher would prefer it if Thatcher would have campaigned for the stay. Campaign.
That's completely nuts. Yes, indeed, that assertion is completely nuts. Indeed,
from her former private secretary.
Well, Sir Bill Cash today in Daily Mail, I understand, and I hope we can say these sort of things on Audio Boom.
I tweeted out the letter.
Oh, excellent. Well, then you know, in the sense that Sir Bill Cash has evidence.
Yes, exactly.
Now, this is hard evidence that Lady Thatcher was against the Maastricht Treaty and would certainly have been against the increasing encroachment of power on the British state and indeed individuals.
But what I'm bemoaning, if I'm you know, putting on the Freedom Association's hat on, is that or taking it from your angle, is that the system is so skewed against you. The irony there is that there's no chance. I mean, there's almost no chance of that of a Brexit happening.
Mm. Well, I disagree with that because it's not just the Freedom Association.
Anybody who turns out to be too good at arguing the point will be vilified in the media.
Well, this is what we were discussing earlier about the different avenues of the media. And actually, now, interestingly enough, the media is becoming more and more Eurosceptic by the day. Amazingly, in comparison to the 1975 vote, you have already the Spectator, obviously, who was anti-EEC at the time. And now you've got a whole range of other organisations and groups. It sees the Sun seemingly is certainly more Eurosceptic than it was, with the Times, certainly, which is the interesting one, more Eurosceptic than it was. Who knows how they'll go when this draft deal becomes a deal, if there is, in fact, a deal. But the point is that there is a slight change in the mood of certain newspapers because they realise that people have had enough.
All right, but I mean, the issue which has come through, which I think somebody in the press has just sort of acknowledged as being a gift to the Eurosceptics, which is the migrant issue. I mean, we have we've already had 300. We have about 300,000 immigrants coming to this country every year, even though it's very difficult to get through border patrol if you're actually a card carrying passport UK citizen, but for other people who have nothing, it's very easy for them to get into the country and get the benefits. But the problem is the main argument against the EU is actually anti-migrant, and that makes anybody who sticks their hand up look like a racist. As Farage and friends have found out already.
Well, certainly, as you rightly say, the media have pinned that tag on certain people for making valid points in the past, and will continue, I'm sure, to make those valid points, and we continue to be decried by certain parts of the media establishment as such and such and so and so. But there is a lot more about the European Union than just the migrant crisis. Yes, it's important because people care about it, but the European Union, as we know it, is a completely different beast to the one the certain people in the UK voted for in the 1970s, and has morphed into this beast that doesn't represent UK values, doesn't represent UK interests, and doesn't represent the British people who cannot throw the buggers out, who cannot...
Why does the UK let migrants in then? Because these people are coming in according, you know, Her Majesty's government is allowing 300,000 people into the country. Without that's nothing to do with the European Union.
Well, it is to an extent, because the EU has this free movement of people principle, and so whether we're in Schengen or not is I think a slight irrelevance here, because a whole range of people who are EU passport holders have come to the United Kingdom over the course of time. Individuals who have gone from non-EU states into other EU states will gain EU passports, and so it's the ever-increasing process of migration throughout the continent of Europe. And so it is actually connected with the European Union, and that's that particular principle. But it's also connected in another immigration side of things, and this is something I'm particularly keen to promote, because our relationship with the European Union and that free movement of people principle means that the UK discriminates against other people from around the world. Because basically, you've got a continent of 500 million people or so with that free movement of people principle, and the UK is looking to cut the numbers. And with that in mind, anecdotally, I know five people from America, from Australia and New Zealand, who have all had Ivy League educations or Russell Group educations, or indeed in some cases both, all of whom had jobs, but because they were entry-level jobs, didn't get the necessary salary bracket or whatever to be allowed their visa. And these guys and girls were in law, they were in fashion, they were in teaching, they were in nursing, they were in IT. And these are sorts of people we want in this country.
So we're sort of effectively taking in the migrants that require benefits, and not taking in the migrants who could actually pay for benefits for others.
Quite possibly. I don't have any statistics to hand, but quite possibly. But the key point here is what I call passport socialism, the sense that you have a kind of passport, therefore you get preferential treatment. That is, in my book, wrong. It should be on the merits of the individual, the merits and their families, to be able to contribute to life in the UK. It shouldn't be because you were born there or you grew up there or what have you. It should be about your merits as an individual, not the passport you hold.
Right. And if there's no Brexit, would you take that as a failure for the Freedom Association, or would you take it as the system's bent and it needs to be changed because democracy has not been allowed to take place in a correct manner?
Well, we'll see how the vote goes in that particular instance, but I'd hope it's free and fair and that there's no particular issues arising from that. I would like to point out, though, the Freedom Association is far more than just the Better Off Out campaign. It's been, as I said earlier, run for 40 years, had a whole range of campaigns, and with our principles, individual freedom, personal and family responsibility, the rule of law, limited government, a belief in free market economics, a belief in national parliamentary democracy, as well as strong national defences, we will continue to put the case for the individual. We'll continue to put the case for our principles through the multitude of campaigns we could run because of the way governments are treating individuals in the UK.
With thanks to Simon French, Rory Broomfield and Francis Hunt, this has been The Collection. I'm Zach Meir.